Often, in their religious ecstasy, they filled the streets with screeching like some odd aviary. In fact, the Fremen called them passage birds, and the few who died here were winged souls. With a sigh, Paul thought how each new planet his legion subjugated opened new sources of pilgrims. They came out of gratitude for the peace of Muad'Dib. Everywhere there is peace, Paul thought. Everywhere, except in the heart of Muad'Dib. He felt that some element of himself lay immersed in frosty hoar darkness without end. His prescient power had tampered with the image of the universe held by all mankind. He had shaken the safe cosmos and replaced security with his jihad. He had outfought and outthought and outpredicted the universe of men, but a certainty filled him that this universe still eluded him. This planet beneath him, which he had commanded be remade from desert into a water-rich paradise, it was alive. It had a pulse as dynamic as that of any human. It fought him, resisted, slipped away from his commands. A hand crept into Paul's. He looked down to see Chaney peering up at him, concern in her eyes. Those eyes drank him and she whispered, "Please, love, do not battle with your Rue self." An outpouring of emotion swept upward from her hand, buoyed him. "Sihaya," he whispered. "We must go to the desert soon," she said in a low voice. He squeezed her hand, released it, returned to the table where he remained standing. Chaney took a seat. Irulan stared at the papers in front of Stilgar, her mouth a tight line. "Irulan proposes herself as mother of the Imperial heir," Paul said. He glanced at Chaney, back to Irulan, who refused to meet his gaze. "We all know she holds no love for me." Irulan went very still. "I know the political arguments," Paul said. "It's the human arguments which concern me. I think if the princess consort were not bound by the commands of the Bene Gesserit, if she did not seek this out of desires for personal power, my reaction might be very different. As matters stand, though, I reject this proposal." Irulan took a deep, shaky breath. Paul, resuming his seat, thought he had never seen her under such poor control. Leaning toward her, he said, "Irulan, I am truly sorry." She lifted her chin, a look of pure fury in her eyes. "I don't want your pity," she hissed, and turning to Stilgar, "is there more that's urgent and dire?" Holding his gaze firmly on Paul, Stilgar said, "One more matter, my lord. The Guild again proposes a formal embassy here on Arrakis." "One of the deep space kind?" Korba asked, his voice full of fanatic loathing. "Presumably," Stilgar said. "A matter to be considered with the utmost care, my lord," Korba warned. "The Council of Naibes would not like it, and the actual guildsmen here on Arrakis, they contaminate the very ground they touch." "They live in tanks and don't touch the ground," Paul said, letting his voice reveal irritation. "The Naibes might take matters into their own hands, my lord," Korba said. Paul glared at him. "They are Fremen after all, my lord," Korba insisted. "We well remember how the Guild brought those who oppressed us. We have not forgotten the way they blackmailed a spice ransom from us to keep our secrets from our enemies. They drained us of every—" "Enough!" Paul snapped. "Do you think I have forgotten?" As though he had just awakened to the import of his own words, Korba stuttered unintelligibly. Then, "My lord, forgive me. I did not mean to imply you are not Fremen. I did not—" "They'll send a steersman," Paul said. "It isn't likely a steersman would come here if he could see danger in it." Her mouth dry with sudden fear, Irulan said, "You've seen a steersman come here?" "Of course I haven't seen a steersman," Paul said, mimicking her tone. "But I can see where one's been and where one's going. Let them send us a steersman. Perhaps I have a use for such a one." "So ordered," Stilgar said. And Irulan, hiding a smile behind her hand, thought, "It's true then. Our emperor cannot see a steersman. They are mutually blind." The conspiracy is hidden.
Once more, the drama begins. The Emperor Paul Muad'Dib on his ascension to the Lion Throne. Aaliyah peered down from her spy window into the great reception hall to watch the advance of the guild entourage. The sharply silver light of noon poured through the clerestory windows onto a floor worked in green, blue, and eggshell tiles to simulate a bayou with water plants and, here and there, a splash of exotic colour to indicate bird or animal. Guildsmen moved across the tile pattern like hunters stalking their prey in a strange jungle. They formed a moving design of grey robes, black robes, orange robes, all arrayed in a deceptively random way around the transparent tank where the steersman ambassador swam in his orange gas. The tank slid on its supporting field, towed by two grey-robed attendants, like a rectangular ship being warped into its dock. Directly beneath her, Paul sat on the Lion Throne on its raised dais. He wore the new formal crown with its fish and fist emblems. The jeweled golden robes of state covered his body. The shimmering of a personal shield surrounded him. Two wings of bodyguards fanned out on both sides along the dais and down the steps. Stilgar stood two steps below Paul's right hand in a white robe with a yellow rope for a belt. Sibling empathy told her that Paul seethed with the same agitation she was experiencing, although she doubted another could detect it. His attention remained on an orange-robed attendant whose blindly staring metal eyes looked neither to right nor to left. This attendant walked at the right front corner of the ambassador's troop like a military outrider. A rather flat face beneath curly black hair, such of his figure as could be seen beneath the orange robe, every gesture shouted a familiar identity. It was Duncan Idaho. It could not be Duncan Idaho, yet it was. Captive memories absorbed in the womb during the moment of her mother's spice change identified this man for Aaliyah by a Rihanni decipherment which cut through all camouflage. Paul was seeing him, she knew, out of countless personal experiences, out of gratitudes and youthful sharing. It was Duncan. Aaliyah shuddered. There could be only one answer. This was a Tlilaxu Gola, a being reconstructed from the dead flesh of the original. That original had perished saving Paul. This could only be a product of the axolotl tanks. The Gola walked with the cock-footed alertness of a master swordsman. He came to a halt as the ambassador's tank glided to a stop 10 paces from the steps of the dais. In the Bene Gesserit way she could not escape, Aaliyah read Paul's disquiet. He no longer looked at the figure out of his past. Not looking, his whole being stared. Muscles strained against restrictions as he nodded to the guild ambassador, said, "I am told your name is Edric. We welcome you to our court in the hope this will bring new understanding between us." The steersman assumed a sybaritic reclining pose in his orange gas, popped a melange capsule into his mouth before meeting Paul's gaze. The tiny transducer orbiting a corner of the guildsman's tank reproduced a coughing sound, then the rasping, uninvolved voice. "I abase myself before my emperor and beg leave to present my credentials and offer a small gift." An aide passed a scroll up to Stilgar, who studied it scowling, then nodded to Paul. Both Stilgar and Paul turned then toward the Gola, standing patiently below the dais. "Indeed, my emperor has discerned the gift," Edric said. "We are pleased to accept your credentials," Paul said. "Explain the gift." Edric rolled in the tank, bringing his attention to bear on the Gola. "This is a man called Hate. H-A-Y-T," he said, spelling the name. According to our investigators, he has a most curious history. He was killed here on Arrakis, a grievous head wound which required many months of regrowth. The body was sold to the Beni Tlilax as that of a master swordsman, an adept of the Ginnoz school. It came to our attention that this must be Duncan Idaho, the trusted retainer of your household. We brought him as a gift befitting an emperor. Edric peered up at Paul. Is it not Idaho, sire? Restraint and caution gripped Paul's voice. He has the aspect of Idaho. Does Paul see something I don't? Aaliyah wondered. No, it's Duncan. The man called Hate stood impassively, metal eyes fixed straight ahead, body relaxed. No sign escaped him to indicate he knew himself to be the object of discussion. According to our best knowledge, it's Idaho, Edric said. He's called Hate now, Paul said. A curious name. Sire, there's no divining how or why the Tlilaxu bestow names, Edric said. But names can be changed. The Tlilaxu name is of little importance. This is a Tlilaxu thing, Paul thought. There's the problem. The Bene Tlilax held little attachment to phenomenal nature. Good and evil carried strange meanings in their philosophy. What might they have incorporated in Idaho's flesh out of design or whim? Paul glanced at Stilgar, noted the Fremen's superstitious awe. It was an emotion echoed all through his Fremen guard. Stilgar's mind would be speculating about the loathsome habits of guildsmen, of Tlilaxu, and of Golas. Turning toward the Gola, Paul said, Hate, is that your only name? A serene smile spread over the Gola's dark features. The metal eyes lifted, centered on Paul, but maintained their mechanical stare. That is how I am called, my lord, Hate. In her dark spyhole, Aaliyah trembled. It was Idaho's voice, a quality of sound so precise she sensed its imprint upon her cells. May it please my lord, the Gola added. If I say his voice gives me pleasure, this is a sign, say the Bene Tlilax, that I have heard the voice before. But you don't know this for sure, Paul said. I know nothing of my past for sure, my lord. It was explained that I can have no memory of my former life. All that remains from before is the pattern set by the genes. There are, however, niches into which once familiar things may fit. There are voices, places, foods, faces, sounds, actions, a sword in my hand, the controls of a thopter. Noting how intently the guildsman watched this exchange, Paul asked, Do you understand that you're a gift? It was explained to me, my lord. Paul sat back, hands resting on the arms of the throne. What debt do I owe Duncan's flesh? He wondered. The man died saving my life. But this is not Idaho. This is a Gola. Yet here were body and mind which had taught Paul to fly a thopter as though the wings grew from his own shoulders. Paul knew he could not pick up a sword without leaning on the harsh education Idaho had given him. A Gola. This was flesh full of false impressions, easily misread. Old associations would persist. Duncan Idaho. It wasn't so much a mask the Gola wore, as it was a loose, concealing garment of personality which moved in a way different from whatever the Tlilaxu had hidden here. How might you serve us? Paul asked. In any way my lord's wishes and my capabilities agree. Aaliyah, watching from her vantage point, was touched by the Gola's air of diffidence. She detected nothing feigned. Something ultimately innocent shone from the new Duncan Idaho. The original had been worldly, devil-may-care. But this flesh had been cleansed of all that. It was a pure surface upon which the Tlilaxu had written... What? She'd sensed the hidden perils in this gift then. This was a Tlilaxu thing. The Tlilaxu displayed a disturbing lack of inhibitions in what they created. Unbridled curiosity might guide their actions. They boasted they could make anything from the proper human raw material, devils or saints. They sold killer mentats. They'd produced a killer medic, overcoming the Sukh inhibitions against the taking of human life to do it. Their wares included willing menials, pliant sex toys for any whim, soldiers, generals, philosophers, and even an occasional moralist. Paul stirred, looked at Edric. "How has this gift been trained?" he asked. "If it please my lord," Edric said. It amused the Tlilaxu to train this Gola as a mentat and philosopher of the Zensuni. Thus they sought to increase his abilities with the sword.
Did they succeed?
I do not know, my lord. Paul weighed the answer. Truth sense told him Edric sincerely believed the Gola to be Idaho. But this was more. The waters of time through which this oracular steersman moved suggested dangers without revealing them. Hate. The Tlilaxu name spoke of peril. Paul felt himself tempted to reject the gift. Even as he felt the temptation, he knew he couldn't choose that way. This flesh made demands on House Atreides, a fact the enemy well knew.
Zensuni philosopher, Paul mused, once more looking at the Gola. You've examined your own role and motives?
I approach my service in an attitude of humility, sire. I am a cleansed mind, washed free of the imperatives from my human past.
Would you prefer we called you Hate or Duncan Idaho?
My lord may call me what he wishes, for I am not a name. But do you enjoy the name Duncan Idaho?
I think that was my name, sire. It fits within me.
Yet it stirs up curious responses. One's name, I think, must carry much that's unpleasant along with the pleasant. What gives you the most pleasure? Paul asked. Unexpectedly, the Gola laughed, said, looking for signs in others which reveal my former self.
Do you see such signs here?
Oh yes, my lord.
Your man Stilgar there is caught between suspicion and admiration. He was friend to my former self, but this Gola flesh repels him. You, my lord, admired the man I was, and you trusted him.
Cleansed mind, Paul said. How can a cleansed mind put itself in bondage to us?
Bondage, my lord. The cleansed mind makes decisions in the presence of unknowns and without cause and effect. Is this bondage?
Paul scowled. It was a Zensuni saying, cryptic, apt, immersed in a creed which denied objective function in all mental activity. Without cause and effect. Such thoughts shocked the mind. Unknowns? Unknowns lay in every decision, even in the oracular vision.
You'd prefer we called you Duncan Idaho? Paul asked.
We live by differences, my lord. Choose a name for me.
Let your Tlilaxu name stand, Paul said. Hate. There's a name inspires caution.
Hate bowed, moved back one step. And Aaliyah wondered, how did he know the interview was over? I knew it because I know my brother. But there was no sign a stranger could read. Did the Duncan Idaho in him know?
Paul turned toward the ambassador, said, Quarters have been set aside for your embassy. It is our desire to have a private consultation with you at the earliest opportunity. We will send for you. Let us inform you further, before you hear it from an inaccurate source, that a reverend mother of the sisterhood, Gaius Helen Mohaim, has been removed from the highliner which brought you. It was done at our command. Her presence on your ship will be an item in our talks.
A wave of Paul's left hand dismissed the envoy.
Hate, Paul said. Stay here. The ambassador's attendants backed away, towing the tank. Edric became orange motion in orange gas, eyes, a mouth, gently waving limbs. Paul watched until the last guildsman was gone, the great doors swinging closed behind them. I've done it now, Paul thought. I've accepted the Gola. The Tlilaxu creation was bait, no doubt of it. Very likely the old hag of a reverend mother played the same role. But it was the time of the tarot which he'd forecast in an early vision. The damnable tarot. It muddied the waters of time until the prescience strained to detect moments but an hour off. Many a fish took the bait and escaped, he reminded himself. And the tarot worked for him as well as against him. What he could not see, others might not detect as well. The Gola stood, head cocked to one side, waiting. Stilgar moved across the steps, hid the Gola from Paul's view. In Chocobsa, the hunting language of their Sietch days, Stilgar said, That creature in the tank gives me the shudders, sire, but this gift, send it away. In the same tongue, Paul said, I cannot. Idaho's dead, Stilgar argued. This isn't Idaho. Let me take its water for the tribe. The Gola is my problem still. Your problem is our prisoner. I want the Reverend Mother guarded most carefully by the men I train to resist the wiles of voice. I like this knot, sire. I'll be cautious still. See that you are too. Very well, sire. Stilgar stepped down to the floor of the hall, passed close to Hate, sniffed him, and strode out. Evil can be detected by its smell, Paul thought. Stilgar had planted the green and white Atreides banner on a dozen worlds, but remained superstitious Fremen, proof against any sophistication. Paul studied the gift. Duncan, Duncan, he whispered. What have they done to you? They gave me life, my lord, Hate said. But why were you trained and given to us? Paul asked. Hate pursed his lips, then, They intend me to destroy you. The statement's candor shook Paul. But then, how else could a Zensuni Mentat respond? Even in a Gola, a Mentat could speak no less than the truth, especially out of Zensuni inner calm. This was a human computer, mind and nervous system fitted to the tasks relegated long ago to hated mechanical devices. To condition him also as a Zensuni meant a double ration of honesty, unless the Tlilaxu had built something even more odd into this flesh. Why, for example, the mechanical eyes? Tlilaxu boasted their metal eyes improved on the original. Strange, then, that more Tlilaxu didn't wear them out of choice. Paul glanced up at Aaliyah's spyhole, longed for her presence and advice, for counsel not clouded by feelings of responsibility and debt. Once more he looked at the Gola. This was no frivolous gift. It gave honest answers to dangerous questions. It makes no difference that I know this is a weapon to be used against me, Paul thought. What should I do to protect myself from you? Paul asked. It was direct speech, no royal we, but a question as he might have put it to the old Duncan Idaho. Send me away, my lord. Paul shook his head from side to side. How are you to destroy me? Hate looked at the guards who'd moved closer to Paul after Stilgar's departure. He turned, cast his gaze around the hall, brought his metal eyes back to bear on Paul, nodded. This is a place where a man draws away from people, Hate said. It speaks of such power that one can contemplate it comfortably only in the remembrance that all things are finite. Did my lord's oracular powers plot his course into this place? Paul drummed his fingers against the throne's arms. The Mentat sought data, but the question disturbed him. I came to this position by strong decisions, not always out of my other abilities. Strong decisions, Haight said. These temper a man's life. One can take the temper from fine metal by heating it and allowing it to cool without quenching. Do you divert me with Zensuni prattle? Paul asked. Zensuni has other avenues to explore, sire, than diversion and display. Paul wet his lips with his tongue, drew in a deep breath, set his own thoughts into the counterbalance poise of the mentat. Negative answers arose around him. It wasn't expected that he'd go haring after the gola to the exclusion of other duties. No, that wasn't it. Why a Zensuni mentat? Philosophy, words, contemplation, inward searching. He felt the weakness of his data. We need more data, he muttered. The facts needed by a mentat do not brush off onto one as you might gather pollen on your robe while passing through a field of flowers, Haight said. One chooses his pollen carefully, examines it under powerful amplification. You must teach me this Zensumi way with rhetoric, Paul said. The metallic eyes glittered at him for a moment, then, my lord, perhaps that's what was intended. To blunt my will with words and ideas, Paul wondered. Ideas are most to be feared when they become actions, Paul said. Send me away, sire, Haight said, and it was Duncan Idaho's voice full of concern for the young master. Paul felt trapped by that voice. He couldn't send that voice away, even when it came from a gola. You will stay, he said, and we'll both exercise caution. Haight bowed in submission. Paul glanced up at the spyhole, eyes pleading for Aaliyah to take this gift off his hands and ferret out its secrets. Golas were ghosts to frighten children. He'd never thought to know one. To know this one, he had to set himself above all compassion, and he wasn't certain he could do it. Duncan. Duncan. Where was Idaho in this shaped-to-measure flesh? It wasn't flesh. It was a shroud in fleshly shape. Idaho lay dead forever on the floor of an Arakeen cavern. His ghost stared out of metal eyes. Two beings stood side by side in this revenant flesh. One was a threat with its force and nature hidden behind unique veils. Closing his eyes, Paul allowed old visions to sift through his awareness. He sensed the spirits of love and Haight spouting there in a rolling sea from which no rock lifted above the chaos, no place at all from which to survey the turmoil. Why has no vision shown me this new Duncan Idaho? He asked himself. What concealed time from an oracle? Other oracles, obviously. Paul opened his eyes, asked, Haight, do you have the power of prescience? No, my lord. Sincerity spoke in that voice. It was possible the gola didn't know he possessed this ability, of course, but that'd hamper his working as a mentat. What was the hidden design? Old visions surged around Paul. Would he have to choose the terrible way? Distorted time hinted at this gola in that hideous future. Would that way close in upon him no matter what he did? Disengage, 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 the thought told in his mind. In her position above Paul, Aaliyah sat with chin cupped in left hand, stared down at the gola. A magnetic attraction about this Haight reached up to her. Tlilaxu restoration had given him youth, an innocent intensity which called out to her. She'd understood Paul's unspoken plea. When oracles failed, one turned to real spies and physical powers. She wondered, though, at her own eagerness to accept this challenge. She felt a positive desire to be near this new man, perhaps to touch him. He's a danger to both of us, she thought. Truth suffers from too much analysis, ancient Fremen saying.
Reverend Mother, I shudder to see you in such circumstances, Irulan said. She stood just inside the cell door, measuring the various capacities of the room in her Bene Gesserit way. It was a 3-meter cube carved with cutter rays from the veined brown rock beneath Paul's keep. For furnishings, it contained one flimsy basket chair, occupied now by the Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohaim, a pallet with a brown cover upon which had been spread a deck of the new Dune tarot cards, a metered water tap above a reclamation basin, a Fremen privy with moisture seals. It was all sparse, primitive. Yellow light came from anchored and caged glow globes at the four corners of the ceiling. "You've sent word to the Lady Jessica?" the Reverend Mother asked. "Yes, but I don't expect her to lift one finger against her firstborn," Irulan said. She glanced at the cards. They spoke of the powerful turning their backs on supplicants. The card of the great worm lay beneath desolate sand. Patience was counseled. Did one require the tarot to see this? She asked herself. A guard stood outside watching them through a metaglass window in the door. Irulan knew there'd be other monitors on this encounter. She had put in much thought and planning before daring to come here. To have stayed away carried its own perils, though. The Reverend Mother had been engaged in prana meditation interspersed with examinations of the tarot. Despite a feeling that she would never leave Arrakis alive, she had achieved a measure of calm through this. One's oracular powers might be small, but muddy water was muddy water, and there was always the litany against fear. She had yet to assimilate the import of the actions which had precipitated her into this cell. Dark suspicions brooded in her mind, and the tarot hinted at confirmations. Was it possible the guild had planned this? A yellow-robed Kizara, head-shaved for a turban, beady eyes of total blue in a bland round face, skin leathered by the wind and sun of Arrakis, had awaited her on the Highliner's reception bridge. He had looked up from a bulb of spice coffee being served by an obsequious steward, studied her a moment, put down the coffee bulb. "You are the Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohaim?" To replay those words in her mind was to bring that moment alive in the memory. Her throat had constricted with an unmanageable spasm of fear. How had one of the Emperor's minions learned of her presence on the Highliner?
"It came to our attention that you were aboard," the Kizara said. "Have you forgotten that you are denied permission to set foot on the holy planet?"
"I am not on Arrakis," she said. "I am a passenger on a guild Highliner in free space."
"There is no such thing as free space, madam."
She read hate mingled with profound suspicion in his tone.
"Muad'Dib rules everywhere," he said.
"Arrakis is not my destination," she insisted.
"Arrakis is the destination of everyone," he said.
And she feared for a moment that he would launch into a recital of the mystical itinerary which pilgrims followed. This very ship had carried thousands of them. But the Kizara had pulled a golden amulet from beneath his robe, kissed it, touched it to his forehead, and placed it to his right ear, listened. Presently, he restored the amulet to its hidden place.
"You are ordered to gather your luggage and accompany me to Arrakis."
"But I have business elsewhere." In that moment, she suspected guild perfidy or exposure through some transcendent power of the Emperor or his sister. Perhaps the steersman did not conceal the conspiracy after all. The abomination Aaliyah certainly possessed the abilities of a Bene Gesserit Reverend Mother. What happened when those powers were coupled with the forces which worked in her brother?
"At once," the Kizara snapped.
Everything in her cried out against setting foot once more on that accursed desert planet. Here was where the Lady Jessica had turned against the sisterhood. Here was where they'd lost Paul Atreides, the Kwisatz Haderach they'd sought through long generations of careful breeding. At once, she agreed.
There's little time, the Kizara said. When the Emperor commands, all his subjects obey.
So the order had come from Paul. She thought of protesting to the Highliner's Navigator Commander, but the futility of such a gesture stopped her. What could the Guild do? The Emperor has said I must die if I set foot on Dune, she said, making a last desperate effort. You spoke of this yourself. You are condemning me if you take me down there.
Say no more, the Kizara ordered. The thing is ordained.
This was how they always spoke of Imperial commands, she knew. Ordained. The holy ruler whose eyes could pierce the future had spoken. What must be. He had seen it, had he not? With the sick feeling that she was caught in a web of her own spinning, she had turned to obey, and the web had become a cell which Irulan could visit. She saw that Irulan had aged somewhat since their meeting on Wallach 9. New lines of worry spread from the corners of her eyes. Well, time to see if this sister of the Bene Gesserit could obey her vows. I've had worse quarters, the Reverend Mother said. Do you come from the Emperor? And she allowed her fingers to move as though in agitation. Irulan read the moving fingers, and her own fingers flashed an answer as she spoke, saying, No, I came as soon as I heard you were here. Won't the Emperor be angry? The Reverend Mother asked. Again her fingers moved, imperative, pressing, demanding. Let him be angry. You are my teacher in the sisterhood, just as you are the teacher of his own mother. Does he think I will turn my back on you as she has done? And Irulan's finger talk made excuses, begged. The Reverend Mother sighed. On the surface, it was the sigh of a prisoner bemoaning her fate, but inwardly she felt the response as a comment on Irulan. It was futile to hope that the Atreides Emperor's precious gene pattern could be preserved through this instrument. No matter her beauty, this princess was flawed. Under that veneer of sexual attraction lived a whining shrew more interested in words than in actions. Irulan was still a Bene Gesserit, though, and the sisterhood reserved certain techniques to use on some of its weaker vessels as insurance that vital instructions would be carried out. Beneath small talk about a softer palate, better food, the Reverend Mother brought up her arsenal of persuasion and gave her orders. The brother-sister cross-breeding must be explored. Irulan almost broke at receiving this command. I must have my chance, Irulan's fingers pleaded. You've had your chance, the Reverend Mother countered. And she was explicit in her instructions. Was the Emperor ever angry with his concubine? His unique powers must make him lonely. To whom could he speak in any hope of being understood? To the sister, obviously. She shared this loneliness. The depth of their communion must be exploited. Opportunities must be created to throw them together in privacy. Intimate encounters must be arranged. The possibility of eliminating the concubine must be explored. Grief dissolved traditional barriers. Irulan protested. If Chaney were killed, suspicion would fasten immediately upon the princess consort. Besides, there were other problems. Chaney had fastened upon an ancient Fremen diet supposed to promote fertility, and the diet eliminated all opportunity for administering the contraceptive drugs. Lifting the suppressives would make Chaney even more fertile. The Reverend Mother was outraged and concealed it with difficulty while her fingers flashed their demands. Why had this information not been conveyed at the beginning of their conversation? How could Irulan be that stupid? If Chaney conceived and bore a son, the Emperor would declare the child his heir. Irulan protested that she understood the dangers, but the genes might not be totally lost. Damn such stupidity, the Reverend Mother raged.
Who knew what suppressions and genetic entanglements Chaney might introduce from her wild Fremen strain?
The sisterhood must have only the pure line, and an heir would renew Paul's ambitions, spur him to new efforts in consolidating his empire. The conspiracy could not afford such a setback. Defensively, Irulan wanted to know how she could have prevented Chaney from trying this diet. But the Reverend Mother was in no mood for excuses. Irulan received explicit instructions now to meet this new threat. If Chaney conceived, an abortifact must be introduced into her food or drink. Either that, or she must be killed. An heir to the throne from that source must be prevented at all costs. An abortifact would be as dangerous as an open attack on the concubine, Irulan objected. She trembled at the thought of trying to kill Chaney.
Was Irulan deterred by danger? The Reverend Mother wanted to know, her finger talk conveying deep scorn. Angered, Irulan signalled that she knew her value as an agent in the royal household. Did the conspiracy wish to waste such a valuable agent? Was she to be thrown away? In what other way could they keep this close a watch on the Emperor? Or had they introduced another agent into the household? Was that it? Was she to be used now, desperately and for the last time? In a war, all values acquired new relationships, the Reverend Mother countered. Their greatest peril was that House Atreides should secure itself with an imperial line. The sisterhood could not take such a risk. This went far beyond the danger to the Atreides' genetic pattern. Let Paul anchor his family to the throne, and the sisterhood could look forward to centuries of disruption for its programs.
Irulan understood the argument, but she couldn't escape the thought that a decision had been made to spend the princess consort for something of great value. Was there something she should know about the Gola? Irulan ventured.
The Reverend Mother wanted to know if Irulan thought the sisterhood composed of fools. When had they ever failed to tell Irulan all she should know?
It was no answer, but an admission of concealment, Irulan saw. It said she would be told no more than she needed to know. How could they be certain the Gola was capable of destroying the Emperor? Irulan asked.
She could just as well have asked if Melange were capable of destruction, the Reverend Mother countered.
It was a rebuke with a subtle message, Irulan realized. The Bene Gesserit, whip that instructs, informed her that she should have understood long ago this similarity between the spice and the Gola. Melange was valuable, but it exacted a price, addiction. It added years to a life, decades for some. But it was still just another way to die. The Gola was something of deadly value.
The obvious way to prevent an unwanted birth was to kill the prospective mother before conception, the Reverend Mother signalled, returning to the attack.
Of course, Irulan thought. If you decide to spend a certain sum, get as much for it as you can. The Reverend Mother's eyes, dark with the blue brilliance of her melange addiction, stared up at Irulan, measuring, waiting, observing minutiae. She reads me clearly, Irulan thought with dismay. She trained me and observed me in that training. She knows I realize what decision has been taken here. She only observes now to see how I will take this knowledge. Well, I will take it as a Bene Gesserit and a princess.
Irulan managed a smile, pulled herself erect, thought of the evocative opening passage of the litany against fear.
I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. When calmness had returned, she thought, let them spend me. I will show them what a princess is worth. Perhaps I'll buy them more than they expected. After a few more empty vocalizations to bind off the interview,
Irulan departed. When she had gone, the Reverend Mother returned to her tarot cards, laying them out in the fire eddy pattern. Immediately she got the Kwisatz Haderach of the Major Arcana, and the card lay coupled with the Eight of Ships. The Sibyl hoodwinked and betrayed. These were not cards of good omen. They spoke of concealed resources for her enemies. She turned away from the cards, sat in agitation, wondering if Irulan might yet destroy them. The Fremen see her as the Earth figure, a demi-goddess whose special charge is to protect the tribes through her powers of violence. She is Reverend Mother to their Reverend Mothers. To pilgrims who seek her out with demands that she restore virility or make the barren fruitful, she is a form of anti-mentat. She feeds on that proof that the analytic has limits. She represents ultimate tension. She is the virgin harlot, witty, vulgar, cruel, as destructive in her whims as a Coriolis storm. Saint Elia of the Knife, as taken from the Irulan report. Elia stood like a black-robed sentinel figure on the south platform of her temple, the fane of the oracle which Paul's Fremen cohorts had built for her against a wall of his stronghold. She hated this part of her life, but she knew no way to evade the temple without bringing down destruction upon them all. The pilgrims, damn them, grew more numerous every day. The temple's lower porch was crowded with them. Vendors moved among the pilgrims, and there were minor sorcerers, haruspices, diviners, all working their trade in pitiful imitation of Paul Muad'Dib and his sister. Red and green packages containing the new Dune tarot were prominent among the vendors' wares, Elia saw. She wondered about the tarot. Who was feeding this device into the Arakeen market? Why had the tarot sprung to prominence at this particular time and place? Was it to muddy time? Spice addiction always conveyed some sensitivity to prediction. Fremen were notoriously fey. Was it an accident that so many of them dabbled in portents and omens here and now? She decided to seek an answer at the first opportunity. There was a wind from the southeast, a small leftover wind blunted by the scarp of the shield wall, which loomed high in these northern reaches. The rim glowed orange through a thin dust haze, underlighted by the late afternoon sun. It was a hot wind against her cheeks, and it made her homesick for the sand, for the security of open spaces. The last of the day's mob began descending the broad greenstone steps of the lower porch, singly and in groups, a few pausing to stare at the keepsakes and holy amulets on the street vendors' racks, some consulting one last minor sorcerer. Pilgrims, supplicants, townfolk, Fremen, vendors closing up for the day, they formed a straggling line that trailed off into the palm-lined avenue which led to the heart of the city. Elia's eyes picked out the Fremen, marking the frozen looks of superstitious awe on their faces, the half-wild way they kept their distance from the others. They were her strength and her peril. They still captured giant worms for transport, for sport, and for sacrifice. They resented the off-world pilgrims, barely tolerated the townsfolk of Graben and Pan, hated the cynicism they saw in the street vendors. One did not jostle a wild Fremen, even in a mob such as the ones which swarmed to Elia's fane. There were no knifings in the sacred precincts, but bodies had been found later. The departing swarm had stirred up dust. The flinty odor came to Elia's nostrils, ignited another pang of longing for the open bled. Her sense of the past, she realized, had been sharpened by the coming of the Gola. There'd been much pleasure in those untrammeled days before her brother had mounted the throne. Time for joking, time for small things, time to enjoy a cool morning or a sunset. Time, time, time. Even danger had been good in those days.
clean danger from known sources. No need then to strain the limits of prescience, to peer through murky veils for frustrating glimpses of the future. Wild Fremen said it well. Four things cannot be hidden. Love, smoke, a pillar of fire, and a man striding across the open bled. With an abrupt feeling of revulsion, Aaliyah retreated from the platform into the shadows of the fane, strode along the balcony which looked down into the glistening opalescence of her hall of oracles. Sand on the tiles rasped beneath her feet. Supplicants always tracked sand into the sacred chambers. She ignored attendants, guards, postulants, the Kizarot's omnipresent priest sycophants, plunged into the spiral passage which twisted upward to her private quarters. There, amidst divans, deep rugs, tent hangings, and mementos of the desert, she dismissed the Fremen Amazons Stilgar had assigned as her personal guardians. Watchdogs, more likely. When they had gone, muttering and objecting, but more fearful of her than they were of Stilgar, she stripped off her robe, leaving only the sheathed kriss knife on its thong around her neck, strewed garments behind as she made for the bath. He was near, she knew, that shadow figure of a man she could sense in her future but could not see. It angered her that no power of prescience could put flesh on that figure. He could be sensed only at unexpected moments while she scanned the lives of others, or she came upon a smoky outline in solitary darkness when innocence lay coupled with desire. He stood just beyond an unfixed horizon, and she felt that if she strained her talents to an unexpected intensity, she might see him. He was there, a constant assault on her awareness, fierce, dangerous, immoral. Moist, warm air surrounded her in the tub. Here was a habit she had learned from the memory entities of the uncounted reverent mothers who were strung out in her awareness like pearls on a glowing necklace. Water, warm water in a sunken tub, accepted her skin as she slid into it. Green tiles with figures of red fish worked into a sea pattern surrounded the water. Such an abundance of water occupied this space that a Fremen of old would have been outraged to see it used merely for washing human flesh. He was near. It was lust in tension with chastity, she thought. Her flesh desired a mate. Sex held no casual mystery for a reverend mother who had presided at the Sietch orgies. The Tao awareness of her other selves could supply any detail her curiosity required. This feeling of nearness could be nothing other than flesh reaching for flesh. Need for action fought lethargy in the warm water. Abruptly, Aaliyah climbed dripping from the bath, strode wet and naked into the training chamber which adjoined her bedroom. The chamber, oblong and skylighted, contained the gross and subtle instruments which toned a Bene Gesserit adept into ultimate physical and mental awareness preparedness. There were mnemonic amplifiers, digit mills from Ix to strengthen and sensitize fingers and toes, odor synthesizers, tactility sensitizers, temperature gradient fields, pattern betrayers to prevent her falling into detectable habits, alpha wave response trainers, blink synchronizers to tone abilities in light-dark spectrum analysis. In 10-centimeter letters along one wall, written by her own hand in mnemonic paint, stood the key reminder from the Bene Gesserit creed. Before us, all methods of learning were tainted by instinct. We learned how to learn. Before us, instinct-ridden researchers possessed a limited attention span, often no longer than a single lifetime. Projects stretching across 50 or more lifetimes never occurred to them. The concept of total muscle nerve training had not entered awareness. As she moved into the training room, Aaliyah caught her own reflection multiplied thousands of times in the crystal prisms of a fencing mirror swinging in the heart of a target dummy. She saw the long sword waiting on its brackets against the target, and she thought, "Yes, I'll work myself to exhaustion, drain the flesh and clear the mind. The sword felt right in her hand. She slipped the kris knife from its sheath at her neck, held it sinister, tapped the activating stud with the sword tip. Resistance came alive as the aura of the target shield built up, pushing her weapon slowly and firmly away. Prisms glittered. The target slipped to her left. Aaliyah followed with the tip of the long blade, thinking, as she often did, that the thing could almost be alive. But it was only servo motors and complex reflector circuits designed to lure the eyes away from danger, to confuse and teach. It was an instrument geared to react as she reacted, an anti-self which moved as she moved, balancing light on its prisms, shifting its target, offering its counter-blade. Many blades appeared to lunge at her from the prisms, but only one was real. She countered the real one, slipped the sword past shield resistance to tap the target. A marker light came alive, red and glistening among the prisms, more distraction. Again the thing attacked, moving at one marker speed now, just a bit faster than it had at the beginning. She parried and against all caution moved into the danger zone, scored with the kris knife. Two lights glowed from the prisms. Again the thing increased speed, moving out on its rollers, drawn like a magnet to the motions of her body and the tip of her sword. Attack, parry, counter. Attack, parry, counter. She had four lights alive in there now, and the thing was becoming more dangerous, moving faster with each light, offering more areas of confusion. Five lights. Sweat glistened on her naked skin. She existed now in a universe whose dimensions were outlined by the threatening blade, the target, bare feet against the practice floor, senses, nerves, muscles, motion against motion, attack, parry, counter, six lights, seven, eight. She had never before risked eight. In a recess of her mind there grew a sense of urgency, a crying out against such wildness as this. The instrument of prisms and target could not think, feel caution or remorse, and it carried a real blade. To go against less defeated the purpose of such training. That attacking blade could maim, and it could kill. But the finest swordsman in the Imperium never went against more than seven lights. Nine! Aaliyah experienced a sense of supreme exultation. Attacking blade and target became blurs among blurs. She felt that the sword in her hand had come alive. She was an anti-target. She did not move the blade, it moved her. 10. 11. Something flashed past her shoulder, slowed at the shield aura around the target, slid through and tripped the deactivating stud. The lights darkened, prisms and target twisted their way to stillness. Aaliyah whirled, angered by the intrusion, but her reaction was thrown into tension by the awareness of the supreme ability which had hurled that knife. It had been a throw timed to exquisite nicety, just fast enough to get through the shield zone and not too fast to be deflected. And it had touched a 1 millimeter spot within an 11-light target. Aaliyah found her own emotions and tensions running down in a manner not unlike that of the target dummy. She was not at all surprised to see who had thrown the knife. Paul stood just inside the training room doorway, Stilgar 3 steps behind him. Her brother's eyes were squinted in anger. Aaliyah, growing conscious of her nudity, thought to cover herself, found the idea amusing. What the eyes had seen could not be erased. Slowly she replaced the kris knife in its sheath at her neck. "I might have known," she said. "I presume you know how dangerous that was," Paul said. He took his time reading the reactions on her face and body, the flush of her exertions colouring her skin, the wet fullness of her lips. There was a disquieting femaleness about her that he had never considered in his sister. He found it odd that he could look at a person who was this close to him and no longer recognize her in the identity framework which had seemed so fixed and familiar. "That was madness," Stilgar rasped, coming up to stand beside Paul. The words were angry, but Aaliyah heard awe in his voice, saw it in his eyes.
11 lights, Paul said, shaking his head.
I'd have made it to 12 if you hadn't interfered, she said.
She began to pale under his close regard, added,
And why do the damn things have that many lights if we're not supposed to try for them?
A Bene Gesserit should ask the reasoning behind an open-ended system, Paul asked.
I suppose you never tried for more than 7, she said, anger returning.
His attentive posture began to annoy her. Just once, Paul said. Gurney Halleck caught me on 10. My punishment was sufficiently embarrassing that I won't tell you what he did. And speaking of embarrassment...
Next time, perhaps you'll have yourselves announced, she said.
She brushed past Paul into the bedroom, found a loose grey robe, slipped into it, began brushing her hair before the mirror. She felt sweaty, sad, a post-coitum kind of sadness that left her with a desire to bathe once more and to sleep.
Why are you here? She asked.
My lord, Stilgar said.
There was an odd inflection in his voice that brought Aaliyah around to stare at him.
We're here at Irulan's suggestion, Paul said, as strange as that may seem. She believes, and information in Still's possession appears to confirm it, that our enemies are about to make a major try for my lord, Stilgar said, his voice sharper. As her brother turned, questioning, Aaliyah continued to look at the old Fremen Naib. Something about him now made her intensely aware that he was one of the primitives. Stilgar believed in a supernatural world very near him. It spoke to him in a simple pagan tongue, dispelling all doubts. The natural universe in which he stood was fierce, unstoppable, and it lacked the common morality of the Imperium. Yes, Still, Paul said. Do you want to tell her why we came? This isn't the time to talk of why we came, Stilgar said. What's wrong, Still?
Stilgar continued to stare at Aaliyah.
Sire, are you blind? Paul turned back to his sister, a feeling of unease beginning to fill him. Of all his aides, only Stilgar dared speak to him in that tone, but even Stilgar measured the occasion by its need. This one must have a mate, Stilgar blurted. There'll be trouble if she's not wed, and that soon.
Aaliyah whirled away, her face suddenly hot. How did he touch me? She wondered. Bene Gesserit's self-control had been powerless to prevent her reaction. How had Stilgar done that? He hadn't the power of the voice. She felt dismayed and angry. Listen to the great Stilgar, Aaliyah said, keeping her back to them, aware of a shrewish quality in her voice and unable to hide it. Advice to maidens from Stilgar the Fremen.
As I love you both, I must speak, Stilgar said, a profound dignity in his tone. I did not become a chieftain among the Fremen by being blind to what moves men and women together. One needs no mysterious powers for this.
Paul weighed Stilgar's meaning, reviewed what they had seen here, and his own undeniable male reaction to his own sister. Yes, there'd been a ruttish air about Aaliyah, something wildly wanton. What had made her enter the practice floor in the nude, and risking her life in that foolhardy way? 11 lights in the fencing prisms. That brainless automaton loomed in his mind with all the aspects of an ancient horror creature. Its possession was the shibboleth of this age, but it carried also the taint of old immorality. Once they'd been guided by an artificial intelligence, computer brains. The Butlerian jihad had ended that, but it hadn't ended the aura of aristocratic vice which enclosed such things. Stilgar was right, of course. They must find a mate for Aaliyah. I will see to it, Paul said. Aaliyah and I will discuss this later, privately. Aaliyah turned around, focused on Paul. Knowing how his mind worked, she realized she'd been the subject of a mentat decision, uncounted bits falling together in that human-computer analysis. There was an inexorable quality to this realization. A movement like the movement of planets. It carried something of the order of the universe in it, inevitable and terrifying.
Sire, Stilgar said. Perhaps we'd not now, Paul snapped. We've other problems at the moment.
Aware that she dare not try to match logic with her brother, Aaliyah put the past few moments aside, Bene Gesserit fashion, said, Irulan sent you. She found herself experiencing menace in that thought.
Indirectly, Paul said. The information she gives us confirms our suspicions that the guild is about to try for a sandworm. They'll try to capture a small one and attempt to start the spice cycle on some other world, Stilgar said. It means they've found a world they consider suitable.
It means they have Fremen accomplices, Aaliyah argued.
No off-worlder could capture a worm.
That goes without saying, Stilgar said.
No, it doesn't, Aaliyah said. She was outraged by such obtuseness. Paul, certainly the rot is setting in, Paul said. We've known that for quite some time. I've never seen this other world, though, and that bothers me. That bothers you? Aaliyah demanded.
It means only that they've clouded its location with steersmen the way they hide their sanctuaries.
Stilgar opened his mouth, closed it without speaking. He had the overwhelming sensation that his idols had admitted blasphemous weakness. Paul, sensing Stilgar's disquiet, said, We've an immediate problem. I want your opinion, Aaliyah. Stilgar suggests we expand our patrols in the open bled and reinforce the Sietch Watch. It's just possible we could spot a landing party and prevent the...
With a steersman guiding them? Aaliyah asked.
They are desperate, aren't they? Paul agreed. That is why I'm here.
What have they seen that we haven't? Aaliyah asked.
Precisely. Aaliyah nodded, remembering her thoughts about the new Dune Tarot. Quickly, she recounted her fears.
Throwing a blanket over us, Paul said.
With adequate patrols, Stilgar ventured, we might prevent the...
We prevent nothing forever, Aaliyah said. She didn't like the feel of the way Stilgar's mind was working now.